because we love them. And welcome to the Interracial John Podcast. I'm your host, Leslie Mack, and I'm joined, as always,
by a very white guy.
And you are very white indeed.
Thank you very much.
So, what's going on there, dude?
Not a whole lot. You want to do your spiel where people can find us in your home?
Yeah, sure. Let's do that. If you're just joining us for the first time, first of all, welcome.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for being here. And thanks for anybody listening, actually, all 12 of you. you can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search Interracial John. That's J-A-W-N. Or you can go to our website, interracialjohn.com. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr. Again, at Interracial John. That's J-A-W-N. And we'd love feedback.
Yeah, so about that.
I'm sorry. So sorry. So sorry. That I was such a
So if you're not the first time listener, if you've been listening to the show, thank you. But as you may know, I've been, I'd say over the last couple of months, increasing the... the fervor with which we request feedback and reviews.
Yeah, you demanded it,
it started with like
you
straight
did the voice
begging.
Of God last
that
week.
That was, yeah, ended with the voice of God. But it started with like straight begging and some other, and like maybe like some like shaming, like, how dare you not leave a review? I can't believe it. Like, I got obnoxious and I apologize.
Because there's a crap ton of reviews.
There's a shit ton of reviews.
So before we do that, let me let everyone know, if you haven't already left feedback, how you can do that. You can leave us a review on iTunes, on Stitcher, which we'd love.
And I'll find it now. And I got it. If yeah, you do it on iTunes, I got you.
Allegedly. And if it's 5 stars, we will read it here on the air. You're going to hear quite a lot of that shortly. you can also send us an email, interracialjohn@gmail.com, which we have an email to read today. And you can also leave us a voicemail at 657-JOHNERS, that's 657-JAWNERS, if it's under 3 minutes. And not crazy, we will also play that on the air. Shout out to Rod and Karen from the Black Guy Who Tips for our general feedback rules. Now, we do have a guest today. We have Ijeoma Oluo coming on, and that's awesome. But before we get to her, we do need to, as you said,
address these reviews
yeah. And make sure people get heard. Yeah. And so
I'll just and not as a matter of like excuses, but just as an explanation. see what happened was that iTunes has like a web browser, and they've also got an app. And I was going in the web browser, and it only shows you like a couple, like 3 or 4 reviews. And I did notice that the count, like the number, had gone up. And I went and I saw someone like. Because there's that thing where if you leave a review outside the U.S., like, you don't see it. You have to go into, like, the localized version. Like, you have to type in, like, U.K. iTunes and, you know, other versions of iTunes. So there was a Canadian review, and there's one from DC Bumblebee from the U.K. So I thought maybe these were, like, foreign reviews. I kept seeing the counter go up, but I didn't see actual reviews. And then I finally was like, wow, there's, like, 17. Like, they can't all be, like, foreign reviews. There's only, like, 3 U.S. reviews. And then there was this little button that said open in iTunes. And yeah, I'm on a PC. See, I have a banking account and a savings and a checking. And I'm on a PC and I didn't want to do the iTunes thing.
All right. Let's wrap this shit up. We got to get to the actual reviews.
I found them. And I'll just start by saying I'm sorry. JKing717. Left a... oh, wait. You know what? We should... Because it is a 5-star review. Crescendo.
5-star review now.
5-star review now. 5-star review now. Bam, bam. So, thank you, JKing717, 5-star review. If you like laughter and unfiltered opinions, this is a podcast you are likely to enjoy. Press play and discover it for yourself. Jay of the Right to R-E-A-L Love Radio Podcast. back.
Well, thank you, Jay.
Back in March of 2015.
March, yeah. We're moving into April now.
If you like it and you leave an opinion, and they might read it some year later, it's cool.
Yeah. Next up, we have...
And I have to again say, I'm sorry. Apologies. Toll for 33. My bad. I'm going to apologize to everybody.
You're going to apologize to each one?
That's we had this week in apologies. We're going to have real apologies. Okay. I recognize the pain and the uncomfort I caused you by shaming you after you'd already left a review.
Okay.
And I addressed that, and
well,
I apologize.
Tolliver33 says, with 5 stars, I don't need your side eyes. I've been getting my life listening to your conversations and listening to the sound bites of your nieces randomly in the show. So glad to listen and to hear people who have the same feels, my same feels about issues. Love y'all. Thank you.
Thanks, Oliver. You know, and he said, I don't need your side eye. That was before the Remy side eye photo.
Yeah,
it was way back in April. So again, apologies. I'm sorry, Cameron Justice. So Cameron Justice goes, they see color and much, much more. I do. Leslie and Drew have the sort of marriage most of us aspire to.
Aww.
Oh, that's right. They have great chemistry. They support each other and a host of social justice causes, and they amuse each other and their audience.
Well, now.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, we have a longtime listener, Hiroja Sheeb, says, a great listen, 5 stars. This is a very podcast hosted by a couple who cover a wide range of subjects from pop, current events, upbringing, relationships, marriage life, social and racial justice, all with a great sense of purpose and humor. A great listen. Highly recommend.
Thank you. And I'll plug, she's got a podcast about electronic currency, Dogecoin, Musings of a Sheeb.
Yes. Yeah. Check her out.
These Johns from Angela Anzi Davis. Apologies, Angela. I'm very sorry. She just said 5 stars. Love the show. So thank you, Angela.
Thanks, Angela.
Sorry it took us so long to acknowledge that.
Next up, we've got Monte Carlo 77, who says 5 stars. This John is a must listen. This show is a must listen. Leslie and Drew are on top of the trends and news that matter. The guests, conversations, and banter get to their hearts and the heart of whatever is on the table. I'm inspired, encouraged, and emboldened to be better and do better for my community and my world. Thank you.
Wow.
Oh, that's a great one. We might need to print that one out.
Apologies, Monte Carlo 77. I'm very sorry. And that review, I think with our podcast, like, we've emboldened him to do better and be better. I was merely shooting for, like, mildly entertaining. Like, I feel very highly encouraged that it's, you know, I feel good.
Doing well.
So apologies, Feminist Rambo. Ooh, very sorry, Feminist Rambo. Really very sorry.
Extra sorry.
And we don't live where we think we live, Feminist Rambo. All right. Great listen, 5 stars. I love this podcast. Leslie and Drew are very real, intelligent. I enjoy listening to them discuss the issues of the day. They have a great guest, and I've been introduced to a number of other podcasts, TV shows, etc., that I really enjoy. I also really appreciate hearing about the activism they do outside the show, because it's both inspiring and lets me know that regular people out there caring and working can make a difference. This podcast is definitely worth your time.
Thank you, Feminist Rainbow. Next up, we have T-Sleeve, who says, love, 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 5 stars. I first heard Interracial John mentioned in a Facebook group that I'm in. It took time for my faulty memory to remind me to tune in, and I'm oh so happy I have. I'm behind, but I've been spending time catching up on your fantastic show, great conversations, great guests, and wonderful hosts in Leslie and Drew. I've spread the word about you and your show too. I can't wait to get all caught up so I can leave emails and interact with you. Thanks for helping me get through my day.
Well, and especially thank you, T-Sleeve, and I'm very sorry. I apologize you even saying that you wanted to catch up and interact with us, and here I am like 4 months later reading your review. So thank you, T-Sleeve. I apologize.
Hopefully you're still listening and you caught up.
And again, apologies to everybody. Occasional admin. Sorry. Funny, interesting racial justice by occasional admin. So most explorations of the struggle for racial justice are interesting, and but warm, light humor is something that isn't usually in the mix too. Leslie and Drew have a great chemistry, which is great for them personally since they are married. That's good for us. But also makes the podcast a joyful listen. Looking forward to catching up on past episodes and getting to know them and their guests better.
Thank you,
occasional admin. And again, sorry.
Next up, we have Taz 5280 says, great podcast, 5 stars. Been listening since I heard you guys in the Black Guy Who Tips. Shout out to Rod and Karen. And y'all are awesome. Keep up the good work. All right.
Thank you. And he put his
handle at
MacTaz 0226. Yes. So apologies, Taz 5208, MacTaz 0226. Thank you for running group. This one also, apologies, PMO. She says, or they say, fun, funny, fantastic.
It's PMO.
I said PMO.
I thought you said PIA.
No, I said PMO.
Sorry.
Fun. And I said she, and then I didn't want to misgender, so I said they.
They.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's
so
good.
PMO. Fun, funny, fantastic, Aki and Saltfish.
Oh.
Someone from the Caribbean, maybe. Leslie and you are on one of my favorite podcast marriage tag teams. Rod and Karen from The Guy Who Tips. Again, shout out to the Podfather. Put me on to Interracial John and podcast fandom. Leslie, IJ, and Nina from Podcast Fam are from BK, so that gets me to
BK all day.
BK all day. I know you all right. Leslie's not here for the bullshit in general. She isn't. You do know her well. She's so active, I can barely keep up with her on Twitter. Leslie is serious, and her intelligent humor are so down to earth, it's enviable. Drew brings the comedy. He's so candid about white male privilege and gives insight to white savior complex. I think my BF suffers from this as well at times. Ooh, all right. Have him hit me up on Twitter. On a lighter note, listen to the hot dog story. Priceless and funny. Damn, there's more. It can tell a story. I also appreciate IJ talking about their faith and church. I'm not a believer, but I appreciate people who have faith yet can call out its duplicity at the same time. Great listen. Outstanding. WCPS, I love when L and D sing What's Up With Carl. I think that might be the first person in the history of forever that said something about me and singing in the word love in the same sentence.
What's up with Carl?
Because usually me singing is tragic. Carl?
Carl's going to be on next week, so that's cool. We'll be
well, thank you, PMO. That was great. And thanks to Black Eye Who Tips.
Rod, I thought there was one more.
Oh, there is one more.
Look at you. You're already ready. Apologize and you're fucking up again, just like a white person.
Easy. Three-piece suit militant. I'm sorry. I apologize, three-piece suit militant. 5 stars, great podcast. I really enjoyed this podcast. If you like being intersectional, you will love this podcast. If you don't know intersectional is, listen to the podcast. Broaden your intellectual horizons a little bit, you Philistine. Well, thank you. That was a more recent one. I wasn't too late on that one. That was actually appropriate.
He likes me for my intellectual.
He likes me for my intellectualism. Well, thank you, everybody, for those
all
reviews.
All of you for your
that
reviews.
Awesome.
That's so freaking awesome.
I feel like such a doofus.
I do, but
those.
I also like got a big smile on my face. It's such a nice thing to hear about the show. And like that's more than 12 people that have listened to the show right
sure,
there.
Sure.
So,
and to get it all at once
maybe
was
I'll
nice.
Up it to 16 people listen, though.
Like a dozen and a half.
Yeah, we'll go with that.
A couple of dozen.
yeah, so we, as I said a little while ago, we are going to grab Ijeoma Alowu and get her on the show right now. Let's get into it.
Speaking of intersectional feminism, let's do it.
And we are back, and we are so happy to be joined for her second appearance here on the Interracial Dawn by Ijeoma Alowu, and she is here. She is editor-at-large of The Establishment, which we are going to talk about in just a minute or two. She's a Seattle-based writer, speaker, and internet yeller. Her work has appeared in The Guardian, The Stranger, New York Magazine, Huffington Post, and more. And she was recently named one of the most influential people in Seattle by Seattle Magazine, and she's also a columnist at the Seattle Globalist. So thank you, Ijeoma, for joining us once again. We're so happy to have you here.
Hi, great to
we
talk to you.
We need an applause
again.
Sound.
Woo! Yes, yes. We're so excited. And I know last time we spoke to you was like right after like MLK tweets had happened. And I feel like your entire life has like completely changed since the last time we spoke with you.
Is that a fair assessment?
Yes. And it's been whirlwind.
An awesome whirlwind, because that means we've been getting a lot more of you out in the public and getting to read all of your amazing work, which is fantastic. I guess first, let's talk about The Establishment, because I know that just launched and I've been loving all the content coming through there. But tell everyone a little bit about it and kind of what its goal is out here in the world.
Oh, yeah. So it is a publishing platform that is run by and funded by women. And it's really operating under the premise that all issues are women's issues. Mm. And really kind of changing that conversation. Everything's been filtered through this white male lens for so long as far as all of our discussions in pop culture, all of our journalism. And we get the chance to really say what we want. And it's been really fun to have so many diverse writers come with so many diverse stories and put them out there. You know, whether it's tech, art, politics, personal essays, poetry, it's just been an absolute blast. So we just launched about a little over a week ago, And the response has been amazing, both from writers and from readers.
Congrats.
Ooh, it's so good. And like I said, all of the content I've read coming out of the establishment has been great. Your Twitter feed is on fleek as well. You guys have your gift game pretty dialed in, which I appreciate. So as the editor at large, I'm sure you're getting to talk to a lot of writers and also getting to really engage with this content from women. How's that been for you, and what's that been like?
You know, it's been really fun. And I think one thing that we noticed that kind of shocked us at first was, if you're a woman writer, you are always expected to write about particular subjects. And if you're a woman of color, you know, it's even more narrow. Mm. And so oftentimes the pitches that we started to get in the beginning really were still stuck in those confines. You know, this is a woman's issue. This is a woman of color issue. And it's been really fun to say, hey, you know what? This is important. But also, anything that you're thinking about that you're interested in is a women's issue, and you can write about that. And so it's been really fun, especially just to see other writers that I love and respect showing up so excited to finally get the opportunity to talk about things that, in all honesty, other editors of other publications just don't even consider them for.
Mm. Now, it's based in Seattle, right?
No, actually, it's based in San Francisco, but we're about split. We're half in Seattle, half in San Francisco.
Because before we really got you on, we were like testing the audio. I was talking about, you know, how Seattle, and you made a comment about there being some a flurry of inappropriate think pieces from the predominantly white editorial staff at all the major newspapers. And you said, you know, is there any women, any people of color in any of these positions? And I guess I know at least one badass intersectional feminist editorial at large of one Seattle-based newspaper. I'm just saying. Only
just the one.
Just the one. You almost did.
I'd say, you know, it's about half based in Seattle.
Okay.
But yeah, it's really frustrating as a writer and now as an editor to consistently see things passed by editorial desks that if they had anybody of color in the staff wouldn't go through. And this has happened, and I'm sure it happens in a lot of cities, but it's been happening in Seattle from so many of our major publications over and over and over and over. And every time the community of color, the artists of color, the people being referenced in these articles speak up about how hurtful it is, and then we get, oh, I'm sorry, and it's changed. But nobody ever diversifies the editorial staff, and it just keeps happening, and it's really frustrating.
You know, not that it's a parallel, but I'm sure you saw Matt Damon when Effie, when he's at Project Greenlight. So here's a woman of color that's a producer. She's got, like, you know, incredible credits and cachet, and like she has a voice. And even in the context, like, no, shush. You know, like, I can't imagine what it's like when individuals don't, whether a writer at a smaller publication, they don't have maybe the power, influence, and voice that, you know, Effie, I assume, has. Right.
Yeah. But this is even the writers themselves. And this is content that gets through. And we see this in so many areas. I'm reminded of the children's book that's about the blackberry pie or whatever. I think it's called like a Just Dessert or something like that. That is a children's book that's based in slavery. It's set in slavery, during slavery. And the crux of the book is this dessert that a slave woman teaches her daughter, who's also a slave, to make, but it's served in the big house. And it's kind of this like sugar-coated like dream of slavery, written by a white person, illustrated by a white person, with absolutely no concept of how inappropriate it is to frame something as horrific as slavery as something like this. So we see this so often, and it is just as simple as having a person of color there and in a position that they can see these things and make adjustments so that it's not this inappropriate content that's getting out there. But it also comes into question, like, that's what I always say about diversity, because I'm sure on most of these publications you're referring to, they think diversity is covering these subjects. They think, oh, we're talking about black people and we're talking about Latino people and we're talking about issues that speak to people of color. And they don't see that when diversity is not a numbers game, it's about representation and it's about the quality and the truth that's being spoken through these publications. So, yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. There's so many layers of filters in media that people don't consider. What they consider, you know, what especially what the white establishment considers, you know, diversification is, you know, putting a different color to the face of things. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what you cover is set by your funders, by your board.
Yeah.
You know, how it's covered is set by your editorial staff. And then your writers are working within those confines. I don't think the majority of writers want to write good stuff. And the majority of writers trying to diversify their content want to write sensitively about these issues. And the truth is if everything's filtered through the lens of whiteness, it's just not going to happen.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
And they're never going to become better writers. The content's never going to connect. It's never going to be true representation. It's just not going to work. And we keep forgetting that the positions, you know, where these decisions are made, it's not the writers. And it's just as frustrating for writers to not have any diversity in the oversight and in the experience of the people that are, you know, shaping how it goes. When I write a paper, when I write an essay and send it to a publication, I can tell when it's been edited by white editors.
Mm.
That's heavy.
The voice is there, just even in the words that are chosen.
Sure. Wow. Man. That's, you know, it's, I don't know what to say to that. You can
there's
tell,
not much
there's
to
not
say.
Much to say to that. That's really effed up.
So what else has been going on? I know the feminist, the badass feminist coloring book happens is the last time we spoke. And did that catch you by surprise? How, like, crazy everyone went for the concept and really wanted to get their hands on one?
Yeah, that was, I think it was really just a small friend project. I was not expecting it to be as big as it is. I don't know if I will ever do it again because I decided I was going to ship them out myself.
Oof.
And I'm not good at that. I'm not good at math. I'm not good at any of it. And I'm sorry for everyone whose books came hella late, but it's really, like, I even, like, accidentally bought the envelopes that you have to, like, lick them shut. And oof. You know what sort of torture that is to, like, lick shut a 1,000 envelope. But I was like, I paid for these.
Isn't that how Costanza's fictional wife died?
Licking envelopes. That's true.
You know, I was thinking when you were talking about just the white lens and just, you know, even when, you know, I think, I'm paraphrasing incorrectly, but even when writers attempt to have an appropriate view, they're still shaped by their history and whiteness, and every stage, you know, it's going to get framed through this sort of white gaze. And I was thinking, was it Mitt Romney when he said the binder's full of women? Like, that was his comment about diversity. Like, we got binders full of women. Come on. You know, like that's just not going to do it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and even his, the goal was like, well, we can hire a woman. Well, we got a binder full of, we'll hire one. Like that, no, that's not really going to do it, you know? And I meant to ask you this, and this is maybe for both you, Leslie, and you, gentlemen. I've seen and heard the sort of statement like, well, you know, if it's just one person of color, if any black person was in the room, your, you know, fuck-ass racist meme marketing shit wouldn't happen. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's a way to prevent it to some degree. Is that, do you think that's a fair assessment? Do you think the individuals that maybe get hired, do you think there's pressures to not? Do you think, you know, if you're the only black person there, you're going to want to stand up and say, hey, yo, that's racist or this, you know, like, where is that line? Certainly it's like pornography. Like, I don't know what it is, but when I see it, I know it. Like, I'm sure there's a line. Every person goes like, okay, Jesus, that's too far. But do you think that white gaze in terms of the hiring, is it just a matter of any black person or does it have to be somebody who's attenuated and kind of, you know, has some, I don't know what, because I think like, do you know what I'm saying? Does that make sense?
Well,
the question?
I think any qualified person of color, that would be my response, is that if they're supposed to be an editor and that's their job and their skill set, certainly that's something that would inherently be a skill that they would apply to the job that they're going to be doing. So that was the first thing that came to mind.
I think also, too, I mean, honestly, I think if you're just going to have one person of color and they are going to be the person translating that, they do need to actually be paid more. I tell people of color this all the time, but sometimes it's just enough to get by.
Mm.
It is so hard to be a person of color, especially in a position where you are constantly speaking about these issues, but still take a toll on you, that you're fighting yourself day in and day out. And then to also have this added responsibility. And I have seen, in fact, you know, I have a friend who is an editor who is a woman of color who's just right now facing a ton of backlash because she was the lone person of color asked to represent, you know, everyone, and other people thought she didn't do it well enough. Mm. And the truth is she can't because she's just one person.
Mm. Right.
And so I think also we have to recognize that person of color isn't, you know, one person of color can't cover the entire diaspora of, you know,
sure.
of skin tones
nope.
that we have out here. And it, that's part of what drives me nuts when we talk about, like, you know, quote unquote minorities, right? Is we lump everyone else into one category. But my experience as a Black woman is completely different from, you know, our Mexican-American population, from our Asian-American population, from our Pacific Islander population. Those are very, very different things. A lot of times people think they can throw one brown person in a room and that's going to cover it all. And that's just not fair to that person in the room.
Right.
It's really
yeah, I have this mental image of like a boardroom with like one of these huge oak tables and like 13 white dudes and 5 white ladies and the 1 Black person and all talking and like, blah, 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 blah. And they turn, well, what do you think? every eye like yep. turns and look at the 1 Black person. Yeah, is this okay? Is that racist? What do you tell me?
Yeah, which is funny to me too when you put in those, in that context, Ijeoma, because I'm always joking around about whenever we just moved to Michigan. And so there'll be like an area and someone will say it's super diverse. And I'll be like, with what? Different kinds of hipsters. Like, I never understand what they mean when they say something is diverse, and I go there and it's just like different kinds of white people, and that seems to be diverse apparently. So that which is funny, minorities can get lumped together, but there's like 50,000 different kinds of whiteness.
Well, that's the othering, right? You know, white is the norm, is the default, and anything's other. And you know, we white people think, and then I'm not saying that this is happening, this is what you were referencing, Ijeoma, but you know, a lot of white people think of Black, brown, you know, anything as just a giant monolithic, like, you know,
not them.
Yeah,
pretty much.
Not me.
Pretty much. So Halloween just passed. What were your boys? Are they, I know you've got an older one that maybe is at the like fun part and doing kind of creepier things. And then you still have a little one that's going trick or treating, right?
So my 7-year-old was a evil warlock, which surprised me because I thought for sure he was going to a Doctor Who thing because he's a giant nerd. But he didn't. The year before he was a clown. The year before that he was a fish zombie, which was my favorite because what's a fish zombie? But my 14-year-old, my freshman in high school, he actually dressed up this year, which was really cute to see, and went to the training, and I love that.
That's great.
He was a zombie, and I did his makeup, and I love because, you know, we always try and tell our boys, especially brown boys, that they have to grow up fast.
Yeah.
And I just love any of these little things where they're still kids. Although, I swear to God, you guys, I did not know what a terrifying costume it was until a grown-ass white dude showed up at my door in a ghillie suit. Trick-or-treating.
Uh-oh.
I thought I was going to die.
Nothing
more terrifying than that. Like, it was... what are you sniper costume?
You got too much time. Well, that's great. And you're right about...
40-year-old white dude.
You know,
like, that's a murder costume.
Nope.
And, like, why does he have a ghillie suit? I was scared. Somebody in my neighborhood owns a murder costume.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, that's kind of creepy. But you're right about the premature, you know, especially with boys, with Black boys. You know, we're coming up on the anniversary of Tamir's death, and, you know, my God, they you know, made him into an adult in a variety of different ways. So that's great that you had that. That's good. And I remember when I was 13, 14, I was horrible. Mom did not – I didn't give her those happy, cheery memories. It was certainly not on Halloween.
Yeah, no.
Little Andy.
Andy was not a joy.
It's not good.
Not good at all.
Should we jump into the news?
Let's do it.
The news is coming on.
Speaking of Halloween, you hear Serena Williams is a superhero.
Yeah?
Yeah, so she was, she had an Instagram, and it's a little bit long, but I'll read it. So yesterday at dinner, the craziest thing happened to me. I was sitting enjoying some Chinese food, delicious, may I add, and this guy stands next to me. It was only two of us sitting at a four-person table, just chatting like we have not seen each other in years, Anyways, I digress. So this guy standing next to me and something, I've now dubbed it my superhero sense, told me to watch him. My phone was sitting in the chair, but I just didn't feel right. He was there too long. Is he a customer? Is he waiting in the bathroom? I tried to shake this eerie feeling. However, I kept watching him from the corner of my eye. Then when I least expected it, lo and behold, this petty thief grabbed my phone and swiftly left. I looked at the chair, then shouted, "Oh my God, that dude took my phone." Without thinking, I just reacted, hence the Superwoman photo. So in her Instagram, she's got a photo of her dressed up as Superwoman. I jumped up, weaved my way in and out of the cozy restaurant, leaping over a chair or two, and chased him down. He began to run, but I was too fast. Those sprints come in handy. I was upon him in a flash. In the most menacing yet calm, no-nonsense voice I could muster, I said, "If he accidentally took the wrong phone." He stumbled on his words, probably not expecting this to happen, while he was thinking of the right thing to say, and eventually he said, "Gosh, you know, what I did there, it was so confusing, I must have grabbed the wrong phone." Meanwhile, my phone was ringing because my sidekick, Quailman, was FaceTiming so he could not possibly deny the allegations. I swiftly thanked him and left. Superhero? Maybe. Oh, hell yeah. I've got the speed, the jumps, the power, the body, the seduction, the sex appeal, the strength, the leadership, and yet the calm to weather the storm. Always listen to your superhero voice. Always keep your things close. Fight for what's right. Stand for what you believe in. Be a superhero. When I got back to the restaurant, I received a standing ovation. I was proud. I just showed every man in there I can stand up to a bully and other men too. It was a win for the ladies. Just because you're a lady, don't be afraid to step up to any challenge and not be a victim but a hero. Super Serena and her sidekick, Quailman.
Oh, let's give Serena a round. Good for that. I love so much about that story. Like, A, the storytelling is fantastic. Like, she's got her answering her own questions in prose form is always good. And I always love an Instagram story because you can write whatever you want as long as you want.
I might have misquoted. I think it was Facebook.
Was it Facebook?
Yeah, it was Facebook. I'm looking at it now.
You can even go longer on Facebook. Yeah. So.
But it was good.
Yeah, it was good.
And she chased him down.
I love it.
Yeah.
I bet he didn't expect that. No. Like, he's stealing a phone like, holy shit, she's gaining on me. Like, who
but
is
I
this?
Wonder, was he stealing any phone or was he trying to get her phone?
You know,
because I can imagine, like, yeah, that's what I mean. If you take it, like, you can get, like, her personal photos.
Oh, yeah.
She likes to twerk, so you never know what could be on her phone.
Dude, that'd be, like, a gold mine if there was, like, a nude or something.
Well, no, just, like, her kissing Drake or something.
Drake photos on there.
Exactly.
Yeah, you're right about that.
Backstage at the hotline or,
Hotline
bling shoot or something.
Maybe there's like SMSs between them where she's fucking like giving them like Meek Mill disc fucking lines and shit. All the memes came from her.
They were on the
playback at the concert. They're from her phone.
She's the real MVP. She's the real MVP.
Like I said, though, I've been in like, you know, not that exact situation like that. And personally, me, I'm just like, oh, whoa. Like by the time like my brain's like, wait a minute, I should get up and move. Dude's like 3 blocks away. You know, just like, I don't react that way. I don't know. Maybe that's just me. I'm slow.
I don't think I would react. I wouldn't be running after anybody. I'm not a runner.
Is there a superhero sloth?
Is there a superhero sloth? You can be
like,
the first one.
Who moves really slowly and like puts you into a trance, like, look out. That'd be me.
That's you. Okay, superhero sloth. Next Halloween, you can do that.
Yeah.
Shifting gears a little bit, I wanted to talk about the Daniel Holzclaw trial, which started this week in Oklahoma City. For those who don't know, he is on trial right now for 36 counts of rape, sexual battery, and other charges that carry a possible life sentence. All 13 of his victims are black women, and Daniel Holzclaw is a former Oklahoma City police officer who conducted all of his assaults while on duty in Oklahoma City. So this happened, the charges were brought about a year ago. It's been about 15 months since we have in the public known about this case. And finally, the trial has started. They picked a jury yesterday, all white jury, I might add, 8 men, 4 women. The 2 alternates are of Latino descent, but no black folks at all.
Despite every single victim being a black woman, there's not a single black woman represented anywhere in this jury at all.
No.
Okay.
None, which is, you know,
I would say it's troublesome, but yeah, it's troublesome.
It's very troublesome. And, on the other side of things has been the lack of coverage in both mainstream media and even in social media outside of black women, really, talking about this case and all of the intricacies that, it deals with. One, he targeted these women because they were black because they had drug or sex work in their past, and he leveraged the ability to arrest them as a reason for his assault, which is certainly not a surprise to any of us that follow crimes that police officers commit. But obviously, this is particularly heinous in terms of the number and the details. One girl was 17 years old. One woman was raped on her mother's front porch. One was assaulted while handcuffed to a hospital bed. Just the heinous and the fact that this man was allowed to be out on bond and stay at his parents' home. He broke parole or broke his bond twice. Once he served 15 days and they let him go back home again, the second time it actually was revoked finally, which was only about a month and a half ago. But I don't know. I actually don't know. I've been talking, a lot of black women have been talking about it on Twitter and on Facebook and in our own circles, but it's definitely been a very loud silence from anyone other than us. What are your thoughts, E.G. Oman? Not just the case, but the lack of coverage and kind of how it's been pitched, or not pitch, so to speak.
You know, it doesn't surprise me. Black women are completely invisible to society. I read about this too. It's mm-hmm. it's not even contempt. It's below contempt. It is complete invisibility. Mm-hmm. And it's so frustrating because people think that not saying anything is a neutral position, but the truth is that these women were raped because he knew
yep.
that people weren't going
they
to
they were targeted
anything.
Because of that, mm-hmm. absolutely.
Yeah. And that's where we have to understand that the responsibility is not just this man. The responsibility is all of society, where men can brag about raping, you know, 30 women in brazen rapes. You know, outdoor rape, knowing he can get away with it.
Yep.
And that's on society. That is on every single person of power, every single person that he would have been held accountable to, making it known that they don't care. And that's just, it's so frustrating because a lot of people are saying, you know, oh, well, it makes sense, you know, why are we expecting white people to say anything? You know what? This is a white person problem. These women were not only raped by this man, but they were raped by white supremacy that says they don't matter and that you can use their bodies just as freely as you could in the days of slavery. And this is definitely an indictment on society.
Agreed.
Far more than this person.
Absolutely.
You know,
and yeah. I think the things that Leslie was saying, the lack of coverage, perhaps the, you know, he got bonded and then his bond went from $5 million to $500,000. So he's able to actually put up $50,000. He got out, violated twice, finally spent maybe 15 days behind jail. All of these steps at which, you know, you see like, you know, like DeRay's fond of, you know, tweeting, watch whiteness work, to see supremacist society do what it does in attempts to smear his victims and clear him of these crimes. Each increasing one that I find just so onerous and disgusting, it's a further indictment of that system and supremacy in society. And I agree with you completely that the individuals he victimized were in a position to be victimized because of white supremacist, mm-hmm. you know, patriarchal society. And, you know, I think it was on maybe the FRN. Who was the guy that was talking about? And I remember I've referenced it like twice now.
Junior Bartol.
He was talking about white people and the consumption of blackness. Mm-hmm. And he described it as necromancy, as consuming the flesh and bodies of black people and dancing around in the graves. And I thought at the time, like, yeah, that's kind of over the top. And then you see shit like this and you're like, oh man, that was pretty fucking accurate, you know. Holtzclaw's kind of, you know what I mean. And I don't know what mm-hmm. is going to happen, but God help us if his trial doesn't include, you know, serious punishment.
Well, we've already seen in the first day, and I'll be tweeting. If you follow me at Leslie Mack at 5 o'clock, I've been doing pretty much a recap of the previous day's activity in court. Just my kind of general takes, giving me a day to kind of digest everything. But during the opening statements, the defense already went in, obviously immediately starting to smear the victims. They had quote unquote street smarts. The person who started all of this, a 57-year-old grandmother, was high on pot at the time that she was stopped, as if that negates him sexually assaulting her.
Didn't the prosecutor literally have to apologize because there was so much evidence? His opening statement was like an hour.
It was an hour and 25 minutes. It took 30 minutes just to read.
Yeah, 32 counts. Come on.
And they have extensive evidence. I mean, they have GPS tracking showing exactly where he was, that these women wouldn't have possibly known it. I mean, because they keep track of the police cars.
Sure.
He did this while he was on duty.
And you know, the other thing that shouldn't be casting aspersions, this, that, whatever. But something about him and just his photos and seeing him and his history, you know, he got kicked out of the NFL. Like, he just, something about him just like, I don't know.
You mean that he's a rapist?
He looks like a rapey guy, but like something about him on the page just, you know, maybe it's my understanding of his crimes, but he just looks evil to me. I don't know. Like I said, I shouldn't say that, but something about him just, I don't know.
Well, seeing as he's a rapist, he certainly is one. So that would follow that he looks like one. But yeah, so again, we'll be following that. And, you know, I've definitely been hearing a lot of that same sentiment, Ijeoma, just that we are invisible. And I think Feminista had said something to the effect of, you know, we have to, people would have to actually believe that these women who may have been drug users, that who may have been sex workers, don't deserve to be sexually assaulted in order for this case to matter. And I don't think that we're there. So I don't have a lot of hope, actually, that there'll be justice in this case, to be perfectly honest. I'm continuing to report on it because I think it's important that the facts get out there and people do know what's going on. But I don't actually believe that justice will be served. But, you know, I'm always willing to be wrong, especially in cases like this. So we'll see what happens.
Mm. I think this is one of those things where I think we forget because lots of people say, oh, well, you know, there are people, it's all that matters. But the truth is so many times we decide what matters based on whether or not it can happen to us.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is that every white person in America knows
this won't happen.
They would never have been one of his victims.
Nope.
This could not happen to them. Okay. And so the news, they're not going to cover it. They're not going to cover it because the people who are sitting there watching, you know, evening news aren't going to, they can't go, could this be your daughter? No, not unless your daughter is a poor black woman. Can't be your daughter because somebody would care. And I think that's where it stops is that people, once we hit that color barrier, people go, oh, can't be me, because that those race lines, the actual lived experience with people of color versus white people is so different, and white people know it.
Mm.
But they don't have to address anything that happens to people of color because they know it's not ever going to be that.
Yeah.
And that's why they don't demand more from their news. That's why they don't ask what's happening. That's why they don't demand change, because, you know, it might as well be happening in a different country.
Mm. And I'm not giving any, you know, a pass, right? I hear what you're saying, and there's definitely a good portion of willful, deliberate, motivated, you know, lack of empathy that white people do. But there's documented, like, you know, they show white people just for whether it's indoctrination into supremacist society over years and years and years, we have a lack of empathy when it comes to people that don't look like us. Like, they'll show up a video, you know, this double blind study, whatever, and they show a needle and someone getting a shot, and it's a white skin and a black skin. And there's like literally very different measured parasympathetic nervous system reactions to white versus black skin being injured for white people. And that's, I don't say that's crazy, but Jesus.
Yeah.
Well, you've never had to. That's the thing. Like, I think when we start with, like, white men, straight white men, right, and we keep working our way down the hierarchy, you've got different levels of people having to consider the feelings and needs of other people, right? Mm-hmm. So straight, cis, white men don't have to consider the feelings of anyone other than other straight, cis, white men. Right. And maybe, you know, once they have kids, if they have a daughter, then they care a little bit about, you know, white women as well. And then you've got white women who have to, for their survival, care about the needs of these straight white cis men along with themselves. And then you've got, you know, men of color who have to care about everyone else higher up on the hierarchy than them for their own survival, to get jobs, to live, to not get arrested, to not get beat by cops, to make sure their kids can go to school. And you've got women of color who have to care about everyone else. And you've got transgender people who have to care about everyone else. And they have to, because it's the only way you can survive. So we're socialized from birth to watch everyone else and consider what they're thinking and they're feeling and navigate in that world. But the higher up and higher you are, the less you've ever had to do that. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't surprise me at all, because I see like the stretch for people who've never had to stop and think, hey, what about an experience that's different than yours? They've never had to think it.
Yeah.
But, you know, you ask any person of color, and they were probably 2 or 3 when they had to start looking around them and thinking, okay, what will white people think about this? You know,
yep.
Because it's the only way you can get by.
And that leads to Mars and Pluto world of difference in those lived experiences. The two you just described, this, you know, whether it's a spectrum, I guess, a continuum, on one end, cishet white men, and the other, you know, trans black women. And you're right. That's a very, very different lived experience.
Right. But it's a lived experience in which one has to consider the other and the
correct,
other does
correct,
not.
Correct.
And I say all correct. The time, it's like black people of color, even women to some, you know, to most extent, we always have to consider another reaction when we're going into a situation that, you know, white folks really don't have to think about a second reaction. How are white people going to react? And then secondarily, I have to think about how I'm going to react.
In fact, my lived experience, I can go off the handle without thinking, and it like is successful like 70% of the time. And the other 30%, I can like demur and be like, I didn't know I couldn't do that. Sorry.
Right.
That's the extent of my having to think about it. I don't. I can just off the top of my head, like, oh, fucking blah, 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 blah. Mm. Oh, angry white dude. Okay, here you go. Sure. Okay. 7 out of 10 times.
Well, we move on from a rapist to an asshole. Halle Berry got filed for divorce this week from her current husband, Olivier Martinez. And for some reason, this turned into a feeding frenzy of slut shaming of Halle Berry, the least of which came from her first husband.
And on what basis? Because this is like her second or third marriage?
Yes, pretty much.
Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, lots of like these.
What about that Kim Davis and her 3 marriages? Shut up, Jesus.
Just ridiculous. So David Justice, her first husband, took to Twitter because I guess he had some things to
no,
say.
Because he hasn't been popular since he left
no
baseball 10
given
years
a shit
ago.
About
yeah,
him
exactly.
Since then. So he took to say, he says, yep, me, Eric, Gabriel, and Olivia were all her knight in shining armor until it ends. Then we all become the worst guys in history. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Bros before? Yeah.
Eric Benet, who admitted to cheating on her while they were married, said, my man, David Justice, is tweeting some truth this morning.
And what was Eric Benet's most recent, like rehab road with Dr. Drew? What was his famous thing?
No, I don't think he was in any of that. I don't know who you're talking about, Drew. Anyways, I don't even know what to say about this. I've never seen such, like, it's so bizarre to watch these things play out because it's such an illustration of a double standard in media and in our society. And it's so public and so instant. And so visceral that I don't understand how everyone doesn't see it, because it's just baffling to me when you see these like lazy hotep ass memes popping up about, oh, Hallie can't keep a man and all of this stuff. I don't even know how to, it's so absurd. It's ridiculous to me. And then to see these exes of hers playing into it is even like,
why she gotta keep a man? Why is it her job?
Hello.
What, she might've left for her own damn reasons.
I don't even know. I mean, Ejima, what do you even think when you see this crap? It's so crazy. It's crazy.
You know, like what I said is some people get upset when like famous couples break up, but I am always heartened to know that at any point in time, no matter how rich, how famous, how long I've been together, it's never too late to say, fuck this dude.
Yeah.
And like, for real, it's just.
That keeps you sane. You get that little back corner of your mind. I'm gonna.
Yep.
Don't be putting ideas in Leslie's head, please. we're gonna cut the commercial break. And,
but, you know, we always treat like women are supposed to want to be with men, and they're supposed to want these relationships. And if it doesn't work out, it's because there's some flaw in this woman.
Mm.
And that, you know, she can't do something. Something's fundamentally wrong with her. She's destroying this woman. We saw this too, you know, with the Kardashians. There was like, what was it, Us Magazine or some draft mag like that.
Like the
like,
Black Widows or something.
The men they ruined.
Yeah, ruined. The word ruined. Ruined. And they misgendered Caitlyn. They put Caitlyn up there.
Ugh, fuckers. Yeah, I know. Yeah, which, yeah, way to misgender Caitlyn too.
The double.
These are grown-ups. think you can make their own decisions. Like, seriously, man?
Yeah.
You know what? First off, even if for some reason Halle Berry is like said magical all powerful woman who can destroy these grown ass men, dude, if you saw that and you jumped in, that's your fault. Like, you're an adult. You're an adult.
I like
she
to
has no magic love spell.
I'm not gonna disagree with you, but I like to envision that her vagina is like heaven magic butter or something. I don't know. Just like,
what does that have to do with anything? Like, oh, that's what gets them all.
I don't know. Just like, you know, like in Pulp Fiction when they open the case and you don't really see it. It's just like, it's gold shining light. That's her crotch. It's like,
okay. Okay. Maybe. I don't know. But I do think it's interesting. Like, you bring up such a great point, Ijeoma, that it is always these, like, they pitch it as though, well, men are in charge of everything until the minute that a woman leaves them. Then she controlled everything. Like, how do we have that working both ways in society? And just to mention a few men that have been married multiple times, just for good measure, Richard Pryor married 7 times to 5 women.
7.
Oscar-winning directors Martin Scorsese and James Cameron, as well as George Foreman, married 5 times. Sir Ben Kingsley and Frank Sinatra, 4 times. You never hear anybody like that ever.
7. That's getting expensive.
I'm just 7. Just saying.
What's half a half a half a half 7 times?
Maybe dudes just suck and yes. You don't want to marry them anymore.
Maybe
and
that's
they need to
what
get
it
used
is.
To that. So try to come up with stuff.
I don't think you've ever heard this story, Leslie, but so my dad passed away a couple years ago, but my folks divorced many years ago, like 36 years ago. And my father was a raging alcoholic and, you know, coming home drunk, falling asleep on the train. So my mom and dad go to a marriage counselor, some therapy, and they go to like 1 or 2 sessions maybe together. And then they have like 1 session, just her. And then there's a session with just Walt. And apparently, and I don't know exactly, my mom tells the story better, but the woman that was the therapist meets with my father, Walt. And he starts saying things like she's fat and she doesn't cook anymore. Like literally starts like trashing my mom, like to the therapist. Therapist talks to my mom. At the end, she's like, leave him. Get out. Run.
No, I think your mom tells it that she spoke to Walt. She spoke to her, to your mom. She spoke to them together. And then it's like they're going to leave. And she asks your mom to like stay back. She's like, oh, let me talk to you for a minute. And she's like, yeah, you
run,
need to,
girl,
you
run.
You need to go, girl. Mm-mm. Like the therapist was like, get the fuck away from that guy.
No, but and then the same thing with our, you know, his side of the family and my mom's side of the family. There was a total narrative on his side that, you know, she was horrible and she's the reason that they got a divorce. And she's keeping him from seeing his kids. Like, no, you're a fucking fall down drunk. It's pretty shut and you know, open and closed case here.
Yeah, exactly.
Dudes. Mm-hmm. Fucking cool. Dudes.
Dudes suck. That's maybe we'll call this show that. Mm.
Anyways, dudes suck.
Dudes suck. With Ijeoma.
Hey, you know what though?
Sign me up. I'll do this.
On behalf of all men.
I'm sorry.
But all kidding aside, we do have a segment this week in Sorry's. And boy, Leslie, I don't want to say
you had a lot to choose from this week.
I don't want to say
a lot of apologizing going on out there.
I was thinking, like, you know what? Like, all the really high profile Halloween blackface incidents, like, there have been so many. Like, we're going to do it one year. But 2015 might be the year we don't have blackface Halloween. But nope, that didn't happen. A mayor's husband. Had a KKK Halloween costume, and there was two. In fact, the other one I didn't choose was she was a sheriff's captain in South Carolina, and she wore blackface. And again, her apology was, "I didn't know I couldn't do that. I didn't mean to offend you guys."
Let me rewind to this husband's KKK.
Oh, I'm going
to
play it.
Where do you get a KKK costume? Like, I feel like you just had that. Let's keep it real. That's not a costume, dude.
That's the same argument with
you. Just had it in your closet.
The sheriff captain that dressed, she was supposedly being Bob Marley, and her excuse was, well, I had the dreadlock wig, and I had the T-shirt that had the marijuana leaf that said hi, so I thought, well, I'll just paint my face black. I'll be Bob Marley. It was a mistake.
Because you couldn't have just done that without the blackface? I never understand
that. What the fuck's she doing with the dreadlock wig and a high T-shirt anyway?
You know.
Like this husband, like what's this Mary's husband doing with a KKK costume? Well, I'll play the audio. We can hear this.
Let's hear.
And we like to give these apologies a
rating. Yeah, yeah. 1 to 10. So you'll have to let us know what you score it.
Ah, friggin' damn it.
Commercial.
The
ads.
Well, that's because I had a page. If you wait too long, it like refreshes automatically so we can play another friggin' pre-roll ad. Bastards.
You hate the ads.
I do. too.
They get you every time.
I sell ads for a living.
I know. That's terrible.
I don't know what else to say other than I'm sorry to the community and I'm sorry to the public.
Lahoma Mayor Teresa Sharp holding back tears as we talk tonight about these pictures making the rounds on social media.
Let's call a thing a thing. These pictures are her husband in a KKK robe and hood holding a burning cross. Okay? Wasn't just like a little bit of a KKK costume. You went full KKK. Okay?
Yeah. Men in Ku Klux Klan robes, one of them, her husband.
It was the stupidity and actions of four separate individuals, and it does not reflect on me or anybody else within the community.
Sharp's husband, Carrie, told us the hoods, cross, and bonfire, all for Halloween.
A cousin of mine came up with the idea of dressing up, you know, like KKK members. And so we took a couple of sheets and cut holes in them and wore sheets. And
this is what is his apology, just like a rote explanation
just
of
an
what
explanation
he did.
Of what happened.
Here's what we did. My cousin recommended it, and we fucking did it.
All right, keep playing. And,
very, very poor decision.
Witnesses say the men also took to a golf cart. Frightful for some.
It's not okay for anybody, period. And the mayor needs to take some responsibility for what her husband did.
I'd never realized that it would have been this harmful.
But, you know, inherent in that is that he realized it was going to be harmful.
But not this harmful, guys.
You know what this apology is? Shit, I'm sorry it went viral, y'all.
I truly apologize to everybody for this.
All right, 1 to 5. He said, I apologize. The word, it was an actual apology. Like, the word apology came out. But he did call it a decision. I don't know. I'm thinking
1 to 10. What do you give it, Andrew?
I can't go more than 2 because it just really wasn't like actually genuine. Like, he's just describing like, hey, we did this thing and it was a bad decision. I didn't think it was going to be that bad. I apologize. I haven't downgraded it. 1.5.
Yeah.
Only because he said the word, I apologize.
Right. He gets a 2 just because he actually said the words. But the thing is, he didn't actually apologize for anything.
The poor decision.
He just, but why was it a poor decision?
Because my cousin.
Because what?
He said, let's dress as KKK.
Ejioma, what are you giving as an apology?
Oh, dude, no. I freaking love it because, like, really? What is his genuine apology going to be? He, like, what? What? I'm so sorry I suddenly care about black people? No. It's a perfect apology. He's sorry he got caught.
There you
he
go.
Didn't even say I'm not racist, which I was racist. He didn't even say it. Not even going to try.
You're right. He didn't get one of my friends is black.
No. Honest apology. It was dumb, which it was. He's like, oh, that was stupid. I got in trouble. That's exactly what happens when you're not sorry. You're just sorry you got caught. Mm-hmm. I think that was a perfect apology for a racist-ass dude who's not sorry.
So you'd give it a 10.
Yeah, it gets a 10.
It gets a 10. Ejioma gives it a 10. It's our first 10, I think.
That's awesome.
Awesome, awesome.
Too much, too much.
Palate cleanser time. Here we go.
Honestly, I could just listen to that bass line, those horns all day. Thank you, Carl, for that version of Black Enough For You. So, President Obama, lame duck blackness, I'll be in his words.
Have you noticed that every one of these candidates say, you know, Obama's weak. Putin's kicking sand in his face. When I talk to Putin, he's going to straighten out. Just looking at him, he's going to be. And then it turns out they can't handle a bunch of CNBC moderators.
Ooh, he's trolling.
I mean, let me tell you.
You had to pause for the laugh.
Yes, the beat.
If you can't handle. If you can't handle those guys, You know, then I don't think the Chinese and the Russians are going to be too worried about you.
He did. That was like a little like Richard Pryor like timing he had going on there. He's gotten extra block in the end of the second
President
term.
Obama. Did you see the letter they tried to go with? Like after the debate debacle, I forget which one of these like 17 white dudes is running, had a letter saying like, oh, you know, these are the debate rules and we're going to all sign in unity. And if we all sign, and right away, Trump's like, nah, not going
to
do it.
Trump is the ultimate troll. Honest to goodness, I've never seen anything like it in my life. I don't even know what to say about it. It's unbelievable, actually.
It's entertaining.
Is it?
Yeah. That's why it's the polls.
I mean, it's like literally you can log on Twitter and you can see a bunch of little mini Trumps on there, you know, saying, show me your dance, and you saw it. Like, literally, it's just, he's just a giant Twitter troll with bad hair.
Yeah.
Really bad hair.
Who's still leading in the polls. I think I saw the latest numbers, and he's still in the lead. It's insane.
I absolutely, absolutely fail to believe that's going to go anywhere past the primary. Iowa's just, that's just not going to happen. But Herman Cain was leading in the polls at this point last election.
This is true. That's true. Good point on that one. Yes. So I think we have some weed news, yes?
Oh, you know what? You gave me this intro that I didn't know I had to queue up. Hold on. It's good. It's good.
The weed news intro is good.
Yeah. Put the game clock at 4:20.
Smoke weed every day.
That's Vine of the Year right there.
That's a
Put
good
the
one.
Game clock at 4:20.
That's good. So, Ohioans, yes, Ohio, you got something right last night during the election. Rejected issue number 3, which would have legalized marijuana in the state of Ohio. Lots of reasons to not do that. Number one being that issue 3, which was handily defeated. I think it was like a 2-1 vote.
Large margin.
Large margin. Because it would have basically given 10 wealthy white Ohioans the sole right to procure and cultivate the newly legalized crop of marijuana. And also
sell it in a limited number of places.
And only to add to that number of 10 rich white men who spent $25 million over the last year and a half to get this this issue on the ballot, you would have to do the same exact thing that they did.
A ballot initiative
to change the Constitution.
Do you know who one of those 10 dudes is?
Nick Lachey.
That's so disappointing.
Why?
98 degrees, God damn it. Oh, Nick Lachey, why, buddy, why?
So obviously this raises this huge issue with marijuana legalization, which has been, you know, obviously making headway across the country, actually across the world. I hear Mexico is starting to consider it. I know Uruguay has already passed it. Portugal, lots of other countries. Argentina as well. So, Ijeoma, you live in a legalized marijuana state currently. Mm-hmm. And it's been interesting seeing obviously, as most things entrenched in capitalism, benefit the richest of us in this country. So those are the people that have been able to capitalize on these new industries as they open up, whether it's Colorado, whether it's medical marijuana, wherever it's happening. And how has it been playing out locally there in Washington? I know you guys are actually the newest state that has open legal marijuana.
Yeah, we were, I think, one of the earlier ones in the state to approve it, but we opened a bit later. I mean, there's weed everywhere. Like, the street we live in, there's like 10 weed shops. But, you know, here's the thing. We still, right now today, have black people in our jail for doing what is now legal. And it's legal because the white people in Seattle wanted it to be legal.
Yep.
Correct.
And there are so many taxes on this quote-unquote legal weed that the only people who can afford it are those white people. And so we still have people of color, of course, who go through these illegal avenues and risk jail to have the same access that white people have to these products. It's really frustrating. I mean, I'm glad that, like, you know, brown people who want to smoke can walk down the street and not worry about being arrested, even though we do have one rogue-ass white cop who's been arresting people of color on the street for smoking weed because it's still technically, you know, federal.
Yeah. Right.
But, you know, it's really frustrating to see that, you know, we have this war on drugs. We have so many people of color doing, you know, disproportionately long jail time for these drugs that white people are doing
just as much, if not more.
More.
And our solution is just to try and find a way to make white people comfortable and have them make more money out of it. But you know what? I want every brown person who's been locked up for weed distribution and for smoking weed and possession of weed, I want them out. That's my concern.
Let me ask you this.
You know, we're making millions of dollars off this, and we've got people still, you know, wasting money in jail.
You were there on the ground, sort of, not like for this fight, but you were in Seattle, in Washington. Did the word grandfather, did amnesty for previously incarcerated individuals enter the discussion lexicon at all, even once?
No.
No.
It never does. I mean, it wouldn't pass that way.
The fifth whitest major city in the country, which is part of the reason why it was legalized.
Yeah.
And so, no, nobody cares. I mean, you know, the ACLU has been talking about it for a while, about reforming drug law, but people really look at those two separate things as far as, you know, what's happening to people of color versus, you know, the law that just, you know, harshes the vibes for local white people. Yeah, no, nobody's questioned it. We're not having this discussion. People are just like, yeah, I can smoke my weed. I'm not even thinking about, you know, what we're going to do about all the lives that have been ruined because of these cops. In fact, it was still frustrating because we had Hemp Fest every year, right, where like all the white hippies get together and smoke.
Right.
And cops, like, were doing this cute, like, handing out bags of Doritos with, like, the rules of, you know, legal weed on them. And they're like, ha-ha, we're so cute. These are the exact same cops, you know, that have been beating and harassing and killing black people and people of color.
And literally, like, a year earlier. You know, like a year ago.
And they're like, oh, you know, we're your friendly neighborhood cop. Yeah. No, you're not.
You know, I know you live in, like,
the Justice Department decided you're not.
You gave yourself away with harsh my vibe. That's like, you must live in a white ass city. You're saying things like harsh my vibe. Don't harsh my vibe, dude.
Don't do it, man.
Killing my buzz.
Well, speaking of police.
Oh, boy. Bad boys, what you want, what you want, what you gonna do? When shall the John Brown come for you? Yes, all fucking cops. So I hope no one forgot about officer in Fox Lake, Round Lake Beach, Illinois. So, and I think I'll go to the first iteration when this individual died. His name was Ron Hickman. The sheriff talked about he's concerned about the increasing amount of dangerous national rhetoric and how law officers everywhere are impacted by such negative speech. This rhetoric ramps up to the point where calculated, cold-blooded assassinations of police officers happen. That's a very important sentence. Cold-blooded assassinations of police officers happen. This rhetoric has gotten out of control. We've heard Black Lives Matter, All Lives Matter. Well, cops' lives matter, too. So why don't we just drop the qualifier and just say Lives Matter and take that to the bank, okay? So that was Sheriff Hickman then in, I think it was July, August, talking about a sheriff that had been
killed in cold blood. They
killed. Cold-blooded assassination.
They had a manhunt and everything.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They did. They had a manhunt. Yep. It was, you know, that was part of the Fox News war on cops.
Yes.
Death of Lieutenant Charles Joseph Glenowitz. This extensive investigation has concluded with an overwhelming amount of evidence that Glenowitz's death was a carefully staged suicide.
Cold-blooded assassination. And why do you have to say carefully staged suicide?
We have determined this staged suicide was the end result of extensive criminal acts that Glenowitz had been committing. Oh. In fact, he was under increasing levels of personal stress from scrutiny of his management of the Fox Lake Police Explorer Unit. We have the highest degree of confidence in the facts which led us to this conclusion, which Lake County Coroner Dr. Rudd will confirm. In addition, we have concurrence of our investigative partners, federal, state, including the FBI, their Behavioral Analysis Unit, and the ATF. With those partners, our investigation strongly indicates criminal activity on the part of at least two other individuals. Because
I'll stop it here. And the criminal activity, if I'm not mistaken, was accused of rape. Is that correct, Leslie?
Yeah, and he also was laundering money from a youth organization to pay for porn and to give kickbacks to his buddies.
So I just want to make it really clear that the initial immediate narrative, and it's always this way from law enforcement, he's a hero, he's a perfect guy, his everything's, you know, blue lives matter, everything's blissful, and this was an assassination, and it's Black Lives Matter movement, and it's this national rhetoric, and it's a war on police. And then, like Ijoma said before, there are multiple individuals and stages where everyone's sort of complicit in this. Fucking media, they just take this shit and run with it. Nobody did any investigation. They hear this, you know, press release from the law enforcement, like, oop, that's the news, you know, we don't have to write it, blink, put it on Channel 12 at, you know, 8 o'clock tonight. And they ran with it, and I saw it all over on Facebook, people talking about it. I mean, like, and I even say, like, quasi, you know, decent, I guess-ish white people that are, like, kind of on the fence of, like, not always problematic, but not always, like, horribly privileged either. They'd be like, oh, I'm really worried, you know, some of the stuff, and these police officers. Like, they bought this kind of shit, you know? And it was a fucking suicide. It wasn't even close to an assassination. It was nothing of the sort. It just ticks me up no end.
You know, I was actually almost kind of impressed that when he staged this, he said that he was being chased by two white guys and a black guy, because I thought for sure he was going to be like, all black guys, but he didn't. Like, he was less racist in his staged suicide than everyone else was.
That's probably why he got so much play.
He was super crafty.
Yeah.
Like, it was so intricate of a setup to make sure that it wasn't seen as a... it was seen as a murder.
And to what end? If it was as a suicide, he doesn't get a pension. There's, you know, disgrace. I don't know. Just why, what a shitty person. He's doing all this dirty stuff. And then at the end, he's like, even I'm going to take the easy way out. And that's the easy way out. I shouldn't say that. Suicide's terrible. But he's made a decision to end his life. And then still in that decision is trying to, like, fuck a bunch of other people. Damn it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. It's just, I don't even, you know, like, I don't. It's just, it's really frustrating to me how little black lives actually matter.
Mm.
That we can have black person after black person after black person after black person murdered, and we say black lives matter, and then people turn around and say, when one white person dies, go, you're saying that black lives matter is killing white people. The levels in the fact that it's, you know, built from so, you know, 500 bodies of black people, you know, that's what it's built off of. And they're going, Black Lives Matter, look at this, Black Lives Matter. And then someone goes, oh, you know what, all that crying, it killed a white person too far. It's absolutely... I just don't even understand.
Yeah,
the level of cognitive dissonance you have to have.
Unpacking that would take us. We don't have enough episodes to unpack the. You know, we need like
backs.
We got to call back on like repeated Fridays to unpack all the horseshit that's inherent in that. And you're right. That is the, you know, and when you say cognitive dissonance, that's on the nose, because it just on some level, like I've talked to other white people about, you know, being more aware and sort of, you know, understanding things. And there's this, like, for me and I think other white folks, there's this kind of like snowball, like you've left the matrix kind of effect. Like you start seeing things more and more clearly, and it's like, holy shit, it's really fucked up. Like it's not just bad, it's really fucking bad. Like, oh my God, it's like horribly, like obviously on the nose bad. How are you not seeing this? This is so bad. And other people's like, I don't know, I don't see it at all. You know, so like I get it on some level. I used to be that way. At 18, I would have looked at this and thought nothing of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we'll move on to a lighter subject. Not really, though. Backhanded compliments every woman of color has heard. This was in Blavity today. I thought it was cool. They had four or five compliments that every woman of color has heard.
I bet you know half of them.
Number one, you're beautiful for a black girl. That one never gets old. Or it's old from the first time you ever hear it.
White people.
Oh, gosh. Number two, your hair's amazing. Can I touch it, Ijoma? Your hair's amazing. It's awesome. Wow. You're so articulate.
Yep. Knew that was going to be up there.
Mm-hmm.
Or the many iterations. You don't sound like a black person.
You speak so well.
You speak so good.
Mm-hmm. Number four, you're beautiful. What are you?
Yeah. What are you?
Number five is my favorite because I find it to be like beyond irritating because there's a couple of levels of racism that's implied in it. It's like, you look just like insert celebrity minority that looks nothing like you. So let's spend a little time on number five because it really
You look just me. Like Terry Crews. It's unbelievable.
It's like when Sam Jackson got confused for Lawrence Fishburne and it's like they don't look anything alike whatsoever except for that they're black actors.
His response was the best. Oh, we got to talk about this. I'm the what's in your wallet guy. He's the...
So I just, what is that? It's like if I said that every white person looked like, I don't even know.
Andy Grammer.
Yeah. David Duchovny. Every white dude I see, I'm like, you look just like David Duchovny. He's like, but I'm blonde. Yeah, but David Duchovny, white dude. It's cool. What is that?
I don't know. I have no answer.
What is that, Drew? I can't. For your people.
It's the same thing that makes us like not be able to pronounce Kvigne, but then say like all kinds of like ridiculous white names.
Yeah, like Galifianakis.
Exactly. No problem with that. Rolls right off the tongue. Galifianakis. Covered. Got it.
Hey, you know what's funny about that? Okay, so Zach Galifianakis, before he got real famous, he did a comedy show here in Seattle. And my friend Hari Kondabolu opened for him. And they had my brother, Ahambe Fuleoluo, as the announcer because he was literally the only person I could think of who would be able to pronounce Kondabolu. And
we've got Kondabolu and Galifianakis. Help! Oh, my God!
So it was Ahambe Fuleoluo announcing Hari Kondabolu and Galifianakis.
Oh, you got it. You're part of the tour now. You're the MC. Come on. Let's go. Get in the van.
That's hilarious. That's really good. And of course, now, you know, he's famous, so everybody has his name, so it's cool.
Are there more of these left-handed, backhanded compliments?
No, that was all of them there. The next thing I wanted to talk about was Zola. We have not spoken about Zola's story on the air.
Everyone's talked about it, so I was surprised to see this on our notes.
Yeah, we're not going to go into the actual story or the Twitter story that is Zola, because there's a lot that is there to unpack with regard to sex workers and kind of people's reaction to the story and the believability of it and all the things that are entailed in it. But the Washington Post did a little investigative journalism this week on the story. And
because there were a lot of the things that she said that were like you could verify. Like, yep. It was, like, homicides and, like, you know, shit happened. Like, okay, let's go see if this really is real. Like, you could investigate it.
Yeah, so they say that while no one actually tried to jump off a fourth floor balcony, as happened in the Twitter story, and no one got shot in the face, but in some ways the true story of what happened to two young women in a Tampa hotel is even crazier, quote unquote, than the story that captivated the internet. So if you don't know, Zola is a person on Twitter who said, based on a true story, and she went on this very long Twitter thread where she told this fantastical story of her and a fellow stripper that went down to Tampa with some guys and
superbly effective 140 character prose.
I will say this, her storytelling was magnifique. Okay, it was a very,
for the medium, it was wonderful.
Yes, she did a good job with that. So it went viral. Everybody was talking about it. It was everywhere. People, you know, put it in memes. People storified it. It was everywhere. But what apparently really happened in Tampa was in mid-March 2015, 20-year-old Jessica Siwikotsky went for lunch at Hooters restaurant in Roseville, Michigan.
She stumbled on that white name there.
I did, didn't I? She's a single mother of a baby girl whose father recently gained sole custody, was living in the Detroit suburbs with her boyfriend of 1 month, Jared Scott, and Rudy, a longtime friend. To pay the rent, she had been dancing in Detroit clubs, and she and Scott and Rudy were planning a weekend trip to Tampa. She heard that Wells, her Hooter waitress, also danced, and they invited her along. But suddenly, Rudy, who booked dancers for the club, said the pay was good. So they all went down to Florida, and for a weekend, they should make between $15,000, $20,000, or $30,000. That was the plan, anyways.
Dancing.
Some in club. Tampa. I didn't know. Ijeoma, were you aware of this like hotbed of like high-price stripping in Tampa? I didn't know Tampa was like known for this thing.
I've been to Tampa. It doesn't surprise me.
Oh, really?
Is there like businessmen there? Like,
You know, there's usually, okay, so I know a lot about a lot of people who work in kind of this sort of trade, and there's usually like a row, like a neighborhood where everyone knows that's where you go. And a lot of it depends on like the liquor laws, how the cops are, business establishments, but they're all there, and basically you just go and you work that strip. and you make your money. And so a lot of, like, younger women, college students, you know, they'll go through. And I actually went to college with quite a few women who paid their way through college by, you know, every weekend they would go down and strip, work, and then come back. And, you know, it's a good way to make some money.
You know, hey, on the John, we have many, many, many. We lived in New Orleans for a period of time. Very good friends that were dancers, did it for a living, and no qualms with that. I think it's a perfectly, you know.
No, I'm just surprised that I didn't know Tampa was, like, if they said New Orleans, I'd be like, okay, I could see that, because I know that dancers there made a lot of money. So
even beyond Tampa, I'm old. I haven't, you know, spoken, you know, we haven't lived in New Orleans for almost two decades now, but I, 15, 20 grand in a weekend, that surprises me. That's I knew that you could do well. I didn't know you could do that well.
Mm-hmm. Well, they do go through the entire story. We'll put a link on the show. But a lot of the story was really true. Rudy, who was the pimp in the story, was traveling across the country with a series of women 15 years younger than he was, and had been putting them on, like, Backpage and doing a lot of the stuff that was in there. Both of the women have since left the life, as they refer to it, and are doing well, it seems, based on their responses to the Washington Post. But I thought it was interesting to see this kind of melding of this fantastical story that was weaved on Twitter. And I'm hearing that there's Hollywood has come calling, and they want to do some sort of story about this, which I think is interesting on one hand. But on the other, I think it's interesting to look at it through the lens of how vulnerable sex workers are in general, and how they have no protection. They have no, you know, recourse when things like this happen to them. And they're really at the mercy of so many people along the way, whether it's the men that they interact with, the men that they use as protection, and obviously the men that they interact with doing these jobs. So I think that it's a really important, you know, point to bring up and kind of lift up that we need to do a much better job of. And it actually takes us back to the Daniel Hosclaw story, because the real undercurrent to that entire trial is that because a lot of these women were sex workers, nobody gives a shit about them, and that their lives don't mean anything, and that their plight doesn't mean anything, and whatever they get, they quote unquote deserve. And I saw a lot of that in the response to the Zola story. It was like, funny that, you know, these women, one of them was beaten up and thrown in a closet and all of these things. So, but I did appreciate that the Washington Post went through the trouble of getting the story.
It's a good hybrid.
Yeah. I haven't seen something like this happen before. It's very interesting, all the stuff that's going on with social media. And I saw today that I think MLA put out guidelines for quoting people from social media, which I thought was pretty cool.
So it's now an official, like, Chicago-style guide kind of
deal.
Yep,
yep.
Hey, you know, let me ask you, and I can't remember the term for it, but, you know, I've been reading a lot about sex workers' rights, and there's a different approach from treating sex workers as victims versus sex workers that are perhaps there by choice, you know, as a mode for their own freedom. And I forget the distinction between the two. There's some term, but I don't know enough about that area. Perhaps you know a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is really important when we talk about sex work to recognize that sex trafficking is not sex work.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Sex trafficking is the legal, you know, violation of people against their will. It is a sex crime. Sex work is the voluntary work offering sex services to people. And I think we really infantilize women, especially when we assume that every woman doing sex work is a victim of sex trafficking.
Mm.
When we have adults making decisions, the truth is it doesn't matter why a woman is choosing of her free will to be a sex worker, because she is an adult capable of making her own decisions. Sex trafficking is a completely different thing.
But
when we say, oh, well, you know, a lot of these women were abused, oh, a lot of these women are in drugs, you know what? A lot of Wall Street bankers are snorting coke in the bathroom, too.
Mm-hmm.
So these are adults, we need to treat them like that. And a lot of it has to do with just this infantilization of women. It does not help women to perpetuate this narrative that they can't make their own choices. Now, it also is important that we criminalize sex trafficking and move it separately, because muddying that also just helps muddy the waters between, you know, what is a sex crime and what isn't. You know, it's all about bodily autonomy. If women are deciding with free will to do this with their bodies, then they should be able to. If they are not deciding their free will, that is assault. And this goes beyond just police everywhere. You know, this leads into college rape cases. When we talk about, is it rape, is it not rape? You know, it's all about consent. And so when we look at the danger in sex work, so much of the danger is the fact that it is an unregulated, unprotected agency. You know, women and men are out there working with absolutely no protections, and they're doing labor. You know, they're doing physical labor with no protections whatsoever. They can't call the cops if they're in trouble. They can't get insurance. You know,
they can't call the cops. The cops, like Daniel Holscott, come and rape them. You know, we're literally talking about Daniel Holscott as a cop that was abusing these individuals. They can't. You're right.
Yeah. And so when we talk about helping women, criminalizing sex work does not help women.
Mm.
All it does is it gives them less resources, and it drives a more criminal element into their clientele.
Yeah, and they're already in, as you said, an unregulated, you know, I don't know what the right word is, but they're in a profession that has no protection at all, and then you're driving that profession further into the shadows.
Yeah, and this is exactly right, and it's a global issue, too.
It is. You know, it's even things like, you know, when you look at something like illegal mining, right, and you look at legal mine versus illegal mine, right, the mines that break down and crash and they've got kids working in and dying in, those are the illegal mines because they're forced underground and, you know, the people in power can do whatever they want. It's the same thing with any industry. You have to bring it out of the shadows and give the workers the protections they need.
The World Health Organization has some recommendations for good practices worldwide with regard to protecting sex workers. Number one is all countries should work towards decriminalization of sex work and elimination of the unjust application of non-criminal laws and regulations against sex workers. They should establish anti-discrimination or other rights respecting laws to protect against discrimination and violence and other violations of rights faced by sex workers in order to realize their human rights and reduce their vulnerability to HIV infection and the impact of AIDS. Health services should be made available, accessible, and acceptable to health workers based on the principles of avoidance of stigma, non-discrimination, and the right to health. And violence against sex workers is a risk for HIV and must be prevented and addressed in partnership with sex workers and sex worker-led organizations. So just a couple things that are being worked on worldwide by advocates in that arena. So really important. And so I hope that would be a good thing to come out of this story getting spread so widely, that I think there is a level of humanization of Zola and of Jesse in the story that people are connecting to, that I think has a possibility of showing people that they are just, these are just regular women who are choosing a line of work that's very dangerous and it shouldn't be. So I'm hoping that conversation can happen.
And even in that conversation, perhaps that, you know, choosing this line of work because they've been limited in a lot of other ways. And, you know, I'm not saying that it's not always.
Maybe yes and maybe no. Maybe yes and maybe no, that this just may be their choice.
True, true, true.
I don't think that has to be the case whatsoever at all.
And one thing, too, I think it's really important to remember when we talk about this, too, because I think a lot of people are forgetting this, and everybody who's reading this story is, you know, that only one of the sex workers in this story voluntarily shared her story.
Yes.
And the other one was outed against her will, and that can be life-threatening for a sex worker, and it's never okay. Mm-hmm. And so I think we always, I was really upset to see so many, even feminist magazines, come out with no protections for this woman who has a child and has a life and, you know, lives in a society that still treats sex workers like shit, to be outed against her will. So I think we have to remember that, but it's never okay to out a sex worker.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I didn't even pick, and so you just said that I had never really picked up on that. You're absolutely right, because it was Zola. It was only the one person telling the story, and didn't. Wow, I didn't even cue on that. It blew my mind.
Mm. So we came across this thing that says 23 things that were cool in 2005, but definitely aren't now. I thought it would be fun to go through these 10 things.
All right, start it.
Number one. Proudly wearing your Livestrong bracelet at all times.
That's definitely tarnished.
Yeah.
Recording your favorite song as a ringtone. on your phone. Do people do ringtones anymore? Can you buy ringtones?
I think you can still buy them, but I don't know anybody who
used to sell ringtones.
Yeah, they did. I think they still sell them. Posing for your profile pic like this, and it was with like, you know, kind of
duck lips and the peace sign.
And a peace sign. Yeah, I don't think anyone does anymore.
Writing bullshit random phrases on your Converse high tops.
Yeah, now the pristine high top Converse are definitely the way to go nowadays.
Mm.
Wet look hair gel complete with bleached tips. Ooh, was that 2005?
Somebody tell Guy Fieri he's still living in 2005. It's not a good look. Not a good look. Chunky zebra-like highlights.
Oh, Ejoba, you remember those. The zebra highlights.
I had some.
Everybody had them. Oh, my God. Number seven is me. The hot pink Motorola Razr, a.k.a. the coolest thing in
school.
You
had that, John.
I had that exact phone.
You had that, John. That exact phone.
Who didn't?
Who did? The Razr. Zip around on your Heelys.
Oh, my gosh.
Your Heelys.
I remember our nephew got those.
Oh, for Christ's sake. That was the most irritating thing ever. Like, dude, what are you doing? You're going to break your leg.
Wearing a school tie with your regular clothes, a la Avril Lavigne.
Oh, that was a thing, the Avril Lavigne look.
Yeah.
Wearing a school tie with your regular clothes as a belt.
No, I never did that one.
I got Sarah Chalk doing it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Layered popped collars.
That was the white boy, like, suburban, like, yeah. 201.
Definitely.
That was 2005 was popping collars?
Mm-hmm.
I guess it was in the 80s, and then 20 years later it came back again.
Yeah, yeah, came back around.
That fucking look was ridiculous.
What?
Songs that sounded like an Alvin and the Chipmunks episode. Akon's Lonely.
Yeah. Akon, that was a good song, but
he got that high pitch.
It was a little high.
He's in that falsetto like full time.
Yeah. The iPod Nano. Oh.
Man, we lost ours on a plane. We had a Nano. We'd still use it. I liked it.
So when
my son just got an iPod, and I was like, why are these like vintage now? Like, have a phone.
Oh my goodness. Going to school wearing a headband with your name in glitter. Oh, puffy pink glitter.
Crazy Frog.
Crazy Frog, what's that?
I don't remember.
Oh, that was a game.
Oh, was? I missed that one, Crazy Frog.
Yeah,
it's a game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know that.
Decking yourself out head to toe in Abercrombie and Hollister. Mm-hmm.
You know, I never had that problem because their shit don't fit me.
Yeah, but now no Abercrombie's like a curse word nowadays. I think
Abercrombie's a curse word.
The devil.
I just they never made like they even came out and said like we don't want fat people in our stores. Like kind of like they said like we don't
not
make
kind
our,
of. He definitely says
I,
they
that. That's not verbatim, but I'm
pretty
paraphrasing.
Much.
And I couldn't ever wear any of their shit. Never fit. Nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, come in and give me the biggest thing you have. This looks like a way too tight, slim, like 32-inch waist. Thanks, buddy. Puka shell necklaces. I did not do the puka. Was that 2005?
That came back around to, yeah, the puka shell. Mm-hmm. Number 18, having 1,000,001 different Bang on the Door products.
I don't get that. What do they mean by that?
I don't know what Bang on the Door is.
And they have a picture of an inflatable chair?
But it says Bang on the Door. I don't know what Bang on the Door is. Did you know about that, Ejoma? I don't remember that one.
Mm-hmm.
Number 19, getting into poke wars on Facebook. What was the poke for?
That was there like before they quite... They didn't quite know what they were doing. It was college focused still, and it was kids trying to like, hey, I'm interested in you. So it was not quite liking. It wasn't quite friend invitation. It was like the poke, but they got rid of it. It's long since gone.
No, you can still poke people.
What?
You can poke me occasionally just to be an asshole.
Shut the front door.
Hilarious.
You can poke people? Oh my God, I haven't been on Facebook in forever. I'm going to go poke the fuck out of a bunch of people, dude. I'm going to go poke control. You just gave me like so much fun tonight.
You're never even on Facebook.
I know. I'm just going to go poke a bunch of people. All right. Can't wait.
Letting everyone know when an hour was up with your baby G watch.
Baby G. Shock watch, dude.
Shock watch.
Goes underwater. 1,000 meters. Yeah. You certified to scuba dive? Yeah. No, I can't even swim, but it could.
Owning a webcam. Remember we had to buy a separate webcam?
Yeah. I still, you know, everyone has a computer with a camera built in. My computer is 5 years old and it doesn't have a camera built in. I'm the only person that's like all these cameras. I'm like, nope, don't got a camera. Sorry, can't see me.
Mm-hmm.
Too bad.
Number 22, going out in your bright pink velour Juicy Couture tracksuit.
Oh, Juicy Couture or baby fat.
God bless the velour tracksuit.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not saying I don't like it, but it could be a good look. You can rock it.
Can I? Thanks, babe. Good to know that you like that. And number 23 is Lynx.
What's that, the body spray?
That was the predecessor to, what's Axe? Yeah, Lynx.
There's a bunch of those things.
Mm-hmm.
It smelled weird.
Yeah, and they claimed that you could get laid.
You didn't need to aerosolize like Old Spice Musk. We could do without that.
Definitely could do without all of that. It just seemed to be just like covering up BO to me. I don't really know what else it was meant to do.
Mm.
So I don't know if you're a big Star Trek fan, Igioma, or not.
Is that Trekker, Trekkie?
Trekker is what we prefer.
I did write a couple.
Excellent. So I was excited. I heard that there's a new Star Trek series going to be starting next 2 Januarys from now. So January 2017, a little over a year.
Yeah, what are we talking about now for? Jeez.
Well, you know, they like to get the teasers out there and get all the Trekkers like myself excited. So they announced it. CBS Television announced it. And so they said that it's going to premiere on the television network, but then all the other first one episodes will be exclusively on CBS All Access, the network's digital subscription video on demand and live streaming service, which will be available at the cost of $5.99 per month.
Wait a second. The first run episodes that are new are going to first run on the TV network.
It's going to only run.
On the TV network.
No, no, no. It's going to only the first one is going to run on the TV network. The premiere.
Pilot, the pilot.
The pilot. And then all the other episodes of it will solely be on the CBS All Access, for which you will have to pay the sum of $5.99 a month, $5.99 a month to access.
So they're wow. That's an interesting monetization for them. I don't know if they're trying to build like a brand like Hulu and Netflix and Amazon Prime. But there's a limit to how many of those services you're going to subscribe to. And I know Trekkers will be, you know, but I bet you it'll force like mass viewing parties. If it was me, I'd have like a bunch of buddies like, okay, let's do it and like wait a month and watch them all at fucking once. Pay $5.99 and watch all 13 episodes and be done.
I think it's really shitty. I think it's a really shitty thing to do to the consumer because most people are if you're a huge consumer of this content, like you're probably paying for Amazon Prime. You're probably already paying for Hulu. Definitely paying for Netflix. You pay for your goddamn cable already.
See, I don't think it's shitty. I'm not going to like fight you on it, but content's expensive. They have to produce it. They have to find a way to make money. The long-held existing model of monetization, advertising on TV, it's getting more and more expensive, and you're getting less and less return on investment because of TiVo and DVR and ad-skipping technology, and people just aren't watching shit live and watching your damn cartoon or commercials anymore. So I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but you're not mad at Netflix. Netflix puts on fantastic content exclusive to their platform.
Yeah, but Netflix doesn't have a television station I'm already paying for.
It
doesn't.
You know, I understand, but I'm not mad about this. I
think it's really crappy.
It's.
I don't like it. And I really hope a lot of other. I hope that none of the other.
What you should hope is that they lose money. You hope that they don't. At $5.99, if they make, I don't know what that is per eyeball, but you know, let's do a traditional math. You've got a really popular television program. If you've got 2.5 minutes, 44 minutes, 16 minutes, an hour.
You're just saying numbers.
No, so you've got 32 ad slots, 32 30-second ad slots. Even if it were, I don't know, $500,000, that's only $16 million an episode. You could get that, you know, with a much smaller number at $6 a person.
Yeah? We'll see. What do you think, Igioma? I think it's crazy.
I'm torn. I am for anything that, like, breaks the back of cable companies because mm-hmm. I really do feel like they are using, you know, their position to basically just steal from the American public. And so, you know, it used to be the day that basic cable meant something. And even if you were poor, you still had access to, you know, your main channels. And you don't anymore.
No.
So I think any effort to kind of break away from, you know, the Comcast of the world, which is really what I think a lot of these networks are realizing, that people are fed up and going to other places, I think helps. And anything that gives consumers more choice as to, I want to watch this, I don't want to watch this, and I'm not going to pay for it, I think it's helpful. That being said, it's still, you know, I really do feel like, you know, the arts and entertainment do need to be accessible to everyone. And these things all do add. So, you know, we really still need to have a conversation about, like, who actually gets to enjoy these things? Like, you know, is it just people who have this extra money to keep adding on to things? But, you know, if we were interested in having that conversation, Comcast wouldn't be as big as it is.
Yeah. So, and I'm with you on the decoupling, and it's happening. HBO's got its own service, and other folks are doing it. And this one, I think it's interesting because most of the other, not just decoupling, but sort of non-traditional programming, non-traditional content, non-traditional delivery, web series, the industry or the business that's being disintermediated, right? They're going around is the television studio, is the CBS's of the world. And here CBS is saying, okay, well, normally we buy content, normally we take that content, we put it on a television and we sell ads and all that has, you know, whatever goes into it for X profit. We're going to do it this way and disintermediate our own, we're going to make our own new vehicle. So I don't hate it. I'm not opposed to it. But it will depend we'll on, like Ijoma said, if there's 52 of those and the decoupling of them now means instead of $180 to Comcast, it's now $300 to 72 different entities. That's not a win.
Right. That's my whole thing. I will say the one interesting thing about this particular offering that they're going to be putting together is that live TV will be included. So you'd be able to watch CBS Live through this platform. So it's a decoupling in a new way. But I do think that $5.99 is a bit.
And I bet you that. And that's the exact. Well, you just hit the nail on the head. Star Trek is their loss leader.
Yeah,
the Trojan horse.
Yeah,
yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's for sure. Get a beachhead with Star Trek fans and keep them in there.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have come to the end of our show, Ijeoma. Thank you again so much for joining us. Please let all of the people know all of the wonderful ways that they can find you.
Primarily on Twitter. I'm yelling on Twitter all the time.
Yes,
anything
I
write will end up on Twitter. You can find me at Ijeoma Ongoro and at The Establishment. I'll be publishing a lot of content there. And it's also just a great place to be anyway.
It awesome. Sure is, and we'll have links to all of that on our show notes as well. Anything else?
You know, last time you gave us two really good possible titles, and there was like, I think it was like Poop Plume and Privilege in a Fur Coat or something with a dick. I can't remember what the titles were, but there were suggestions for the, and we didn't have quite as many tonight, but what can we name tonight's episode?
I think we had one, though.
What was it? I forgot already.
It was like fucking white, what was it? Oh, men, or what was it? I don't remember now. I have to go back and listen. Something about men and they suck, or
men suck.
I think it was something like
that. I mean, they do.
That's not a news flash, though. That's not exactly like earth shattering material. We'll have to go back.
We
and listen
could just
to
it. Call it.
You know, I do have a great analogy though that I like to send people. I'll leave you guys like that. So, because lately I've seen it a lot, is like when you get these like really like self-righteous, long-winded like editorials by some white dude who's like, this is how I see the world and how it's changing and it makes me sad. I like to refer to that as climbing inside your own asshole and writing a poem about the year.
Say that again?
Climbing inside your own asshole and writing a poem about the view.
All right, that's a title. The View from Inside My Asshole.
Oh, hilarious. Thanks again, Ijeoma. Have a wonderful evening, and we will talk
to you. You'll have to tag us the next cishet white dude that climbs up his asshole and describes the view for us in Seattle.
So we can see.
Because the world needs more of
see
that.
See the view.
Yeah, the world really needs that.
Yeah, for sure.
But thanks again, Ijeoma. We loved having you.
Good night, everybody.
Always great. Bye.
Bye. High five.